Hey guys and girls, welcome back to the Shift Extension podcast. I am Nick and I'm back with Sonny Whitfield. How are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. It's been a bit of a break for us in between recordings. We've been busy as whole hell, but today's going to be a good one. I'm looking forward to this topic.
What's the topic today?
Well, what we're talking about is, disruptions to our own practice and how people adapt to those. There's obviously changing practice through evidence or through opinion. We'll kind of discuss both. But I'm really excited because we've got a guest with us today, and it's actually one of the very first people I worked with in the ambulance. It's actually one of my original mentors, Nick, or tour mentors. I'm still not sure. Yeah. I just want to say a big shout out to Mark Ward, mate. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Yes, it's going back a few years now.
It is. We're going back over a decade. But hey, really quickly, we both met in a regional hub. You're in the middle of nowhere these days, hey?
Yeah, these days I'm a field officer for Cape York, still with the ambulance service. So my role is to look after an area about the size of Victoria that only has four ambulance stations in it. So
wow.
Yeah, a lot of dirt road between each station. So I look after the bits between the stations.
Now, when we worked together, there was obviously a bit more concrete. Even in that time since we were last together, there's been a lot of changes in practice. Now, I was actually listening to a really interesting discussion between some younger paramedics. Well, I should say younger and older paramedics. There was some venomous disagreement because things obviously change. And it amused me enough to ring Nick and say, hey, we've got a podcast topic here. Because when things change in our clinical practice, and let's face it, they do, it's part of paramedic practice. It's how we develop the profession itself, and it's how we develop our professional skills. People either seem to adapt to it reasonably well, or they clutch on to what they used to do forever, which I mean, in itself can be dangerous practice. But I go back in a little bit over a decade. So is Nick. How far back do you go?
So I was a first responder probably 25 years ago.
So we're pushing nearly three decades.
Yeah.
I just want to put that out there.
I became a student about 5 years or so into that. So I think I've been with QAS for 19 years full time. So
yeah, right, but out on the street for 25.
Yeah, so I used to drive ferries and stuff like that for a living, so I was a first responder on the island I used to work for. So there was an island resort with no ambulance service. You used to get about 1,000 people living on it. So QAS used to look after that, and I was one of their first responders, and that's how it all started for me.
Let's talk scopes then. Hey, paramedics love to talk scope of practice. How varied was your scope back then in those early days?
Mate, I had a first aid certificate and a boat license, and that was about it. We had a few slings, we had bandages, and no medications. You got to remember that even intensive care paramedics back when I first started had significantly less scope than what advanced care paramedics have today. So it's changed dramatically over the years.
Did you ever think back then that you'd have the scope that you have now?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I used to look at the we used to call them intensive care paramedics before they got changed to critical care paramedics, and look up to those guys because they were putting cannulas in and giving people morphine. That was amazing. Yeah, I used to run around with a blue cylinder that had happy gas in it, and that was our pain relief. So it's changed dramatically.
That blue cylinder, the happy gas, I mean, that is one of the adaptions, eh? We certainly, I mean, it's still used in a lot of places. We don't really see it too much where the three of us are these days because other things like methoxyfluorine have been kind of the staple for the last about decade. But methoxyfluorine is also one of those newer drugs. It's now creeping into parts of Europe and the US. It's like the next best thing for some of them. It's interesting to see the way these practices change. I think I recall you once telling me that your scope of practice when you started was Bob. Blanket, oxygen, bed.
Yeah, exactly. And then I went from a boat to an ambulance, so I've got blanket, oxygen, bed, and diesel. So
the change is obviously the part of our professional practice. Now, you mentioned before that you're running around with some slings and bandages, and, I mean, one of the changes I even see in practice these days is, and look, this is probably going to get people throwing some, rotten vegetables at me. But paramedics are notoriously bad at using things like basic splinting and bandaging with slings and bandages, because they don't often get to use it. It's all these fancy vac splints and traction splints, and it's actually amusing when you're teaching first years these days, because some of the sessional staff that you get in to teach the basic skills have actually got to be retaught the basic skills.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you anymore. One of my pet hates, and I used to be an educator at our main training centre at White Island, and I used to push the idea of putting slings on people, putting dressings on open wounds. Don't bring patients into the hospital without dressings and slings and all that sort of stuff. And for me, I'm still using the old cardboard splints. And I'm showing my age here, but you can't go past them, can you? I've forever got trouble with it. I've got a leaky vac mat, or, you're pumping the hell out of that thing because there's a hole in it somewhere and the thing's not sealing properly. Give me a cardboard splint and a big combine any day, and that's all you need.
Give you a magazine and a bandage, hey? You can do anything with it. Nick, one of the changes we were talking about was actually something as simple as rice. What was rice, or what is rice?
Well, rice is it's pretty prevalent in the first aid communities as a way of treating musculoskeletal injuries. So it stands for rest, ice, compress, and elevate. So it was coined a few decades ago as the mainstay of treating patients having these musculoskeletal injuries. But recently, the original author or authors of that idea have actually come out and believe that it's not very useful anymore and may even inhibit the recovery from injuries. And right. You know what? Hats off to this person for getting out there and go, you know what? You know that really good stuff that I told you was what you should be doing 20 years ago? Yeah, no, it's no good. Don't do it anymore.
Look, I've been with rice my whole life, the last, 23 years since I left high school. Rice is easy to remember. But the new acronym I do have problems with because the one that I read is Peace and Love. Now, apart from the fact, it sounds a little bit airy-fairy, I'm flat out trying to remember 4 or 5 letters in an acronym. Wardy knows this.
If
you're
going
to replace rice with Peace and Love, I need to know what this actually stands for. Now, I do because I've got it in front of me on the screen, but I'm curious. If I threw Peace and Love at either of you, would you have any idea what peace and love is when it replaces rice?
No, not at all.
All right, here we go.
Too, mate. I've got no idea.
All right, it stands for protection. That seems obvious. Elevation, at least we're still agreeing on something. Elevators in rice, elevators in peace and love. So protection, elevation. Get this, avoiding anti-inflammatories and avoiding ice. This is going to upset a few people. Compression, at least that's still the same, and education. So they want people to be educated on why we're avoiding anti-inflammatories and avoiding ice. So I throw the question out to you, why, if this is something we've been doing. And let's just also throw the disclaimer out there. The practice rules have not changed in Australia at the moment. Every single first aid course, every single ambulance service is still going to be teaching rice for now until something like the Australian Resus Council changes. So at the moment, it's still rice, but there's obviously a lot of conflicting information out there and people disagreeing with it. Why would this new thought process be saying something like avoiding anti-inflammatories or ice, Nick?
It really comes down to the idea of how these injuries are supposed to heal. So your body is going to naturally have an inflammatory response, and the inflammatory response is being done by the body to promote healing of that injury, right? So by taking anti-inflammatories, you're inhibiting the natural response of the body. And if you ice it, you're causing local vasoconstriction. You're limiting the blood flow that's needed to kind of clear out those dead cells and promote that inflammatory response. So realistically, by doing rice, you're inhibiting and slowing down the body's the natural ability to heal itself.
We're full of good advice. It goes on. Mark, the last part, so that was peace. Love is load, optimism, vascularization, and exercise. So we're actually encouraging people to move the injured tissue. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, look, I believe that's exactly right. It's what they've looked at with this new research is how icing and resting it changes the whole, down to the molecular function of what that muscle is actually doing. So prior to that, it was all about getting that inflammatory reaction down. but don't ask me how I remember this, but there was a 2011 study where they compared calf muscle injuries that were iced compared to calf muscle injuries that weren't iced, and athletes were back on the training field without it being iced a lot quicker than what they were with the guys that were where the injury was iced. And there was another 2012 study a year later where they compared injuries, athletes that got into ice baths, and they found exactly the same thing. But they also did find that not every athlete responds to ice the same way. Some had a pretty good response to ice and got back on the field fairly quickly, and others had a really bad response to icing stuff down. So it just opened up a can of worms, which is why we haven't changed the practice yet. But the wheels are in motion. You know, we've got our celery berry smoothie now, and we're out of our ice bath, and we're looking at the science again with fresh eyes to see what we can do about, you know, icing injuries or not icing injuries. So it's an interesting field that's going to change a lot in the next few years.
It's also, it's an interesting point to raise that everyone is physiologically different. Everyone's going to heal differently. So, I mean, applying a one-stop rule to everyone, we know in paramedic care is probably not the best, but let's have another big change that certainly occurred in kind of the mid area of Nick and my careers was the change from hard collars to soft collars. Now, this one's controversial, and this one gets people talking or yelling. We had a really interesting article also published on the Shift Extension last year by someone I can't recall. No, it was you. But I want to go even further past, just this change. And I want to ask you, do you remember when hard collars were first used in your experience? Was it at the very start of your career, or were they not even involved then?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So at the start of my career, we were putting people in hard collars for sure. Yep.
I mean, they were first brought into service, I think, in 1966 in Vietnam as the first time that hard collars were used to immobilize the neck. Well, what was the purpose of them?
Yeah, purely spinal immobilization, or attempting spinal immobilization.
So did it work?
Well,
because these are still used. They're still used across services today in Australia and internationally.
And, yes, I did pen an article for the Shift Extension on collars, because the most interesting thing that's come out of collars in the last 10 or 15 years is that secondary spinal injuries are not decreased in countries that use collars as well as pain relief and blocks and other immobilization techniques.
So when you're talking about a secondary injury, sorry, can you just explain to the listeners?
Yeah, so a secondary injury is if you've got a spinal cord injury that hasn't severed the spinal cord or hasn't created a lot of damage to the spinal cord, secondary injury is movement post injury that has created more damage to the spinal cord. So that could be from, just say you've fallen off the trampoline, had a few whiskeys too many, bounced on the trampoline, had a fall. You've got up and you've walked around for the next 5 or 6 hours and made that injury worse. That's your secondary spinal injury, as I understand it anyway. So,
and these things can exacerbate those.
Yeah, look, what I wrote and what I really wanted to get across in that article was that it's a holistic approach that we need to take to spinal care injury, because I see a lot of patients collared in the ED and they're juiced to the eyeballs on morphine. They've got a methoxyfluorine whistle sticking out of their mouth and they're still sucking on that. It's probably half an hour old, so it's probably got nothing left in it. And they've got all their friends coming in to visit them, and they're walking to the side of the stretcher where everyone's turning their head because they're not in pain anymore, because they've got so much pain relief on board and the adrenaline's still pumping and they're throwing their heads around like crazy. Where we looked at third world countries in a study quite a few years ago that had less secondary spinal cord injuries, because these people haven't got any pain relief on board. And if you've severed your spinal cord and broken your neck, you're not going to be throwing your head around too much without any pain relief on board. So these people were quite good at managing their own spinal care due to the pain and stuff like that. So
that's an interesting take, eh, Nick? Too much pain relief.
If you think about it, like if you break your arm or you break your leg, you're naturally going to protect that injury. And
I was going to say, I was going to naturally cry, but yeah, naturally protect it. That's fair.
Naturally protect it or cry. You can do both. It's 2023, mate. We're not going to judge you. But you're naturally going to protect it. And the same rules apply for your neck. Is that someone who breaks their neck usually goes, I don't want to move my neck. I've broken it. And you go, all right, no worries. If they're sitting there doing this, they probably don't have a significantly unstable C-spine fracture, right? Unless they're significantly intoxicated by either all the morphine we gave them or alcohol or drugs or something like that, right? So even just that initial assessment of how is the patient behaving is going to give you a pretty reasonable idea of the likelihood of them having a significant unstable C-spine fracture.
Interestingly, I got collared years and years ago. I got collared. And I got to tell you that hard collar was the most uncomfortable thing that anyone could have applied to me. And it made me want to move. So it's actually really ironic that I'm speaking to both of you two at this topic because, Nick, the first time I actually put a hard collar on in anger as a student, you were actually next to me.
Was
up north. It was a multi-vehicle RTC, and I'd never actually stuck a hard collar on a seated patient. So it's fair to say that I probably put it on grossly, inappropriately, and uncomfortably for that poor girl. Mm. And then the next time I actually put one on in anger was actually in the presence of Mark Ord there after an elderly gentleman had tumbled down the steps. And I remember you telling me to go put the hard collar on and you popped an umbrella and put it over him. But it's interesting because I do recall how nervous I was and how difficult it was to apply a hard collar to someone in a car crash and how difficult it was to apply a hard collar onto someone who just tumbled down some steps. And I'd never actually, really been exposed to that in training. And so it's fair to say that I probably didn't put these on that appropriately, which also probably translates to it was probably less comfortable for them, which would then exacerbate it. So we see soft collars being used in a lot of areas we are in now, but like I said, it's divided across our country, across services and, across Oceania. What's the goal of soft collars then, Mark?
You know what, Sonny, I honestly think they're just a reminder not to move your neck. And that sounds really strange because it's not providing a lot of support, but it's around the patient, so the patient's quite rigid and they know that we're going to check their neck for a spinal cord injury when we get to the hospital and we don't want them to move it. And that's basically all it is. There's a lot of other signs there, of course, where hard collars raise intracranial pressure if you've got a head injury as well, and soft collars have proven not to do that. And there's other little bits and pieces, but if I'm treating a patient, I've got a collar on them and I'm just telling them to stay really still. I haven't got too much pain relief on board. I might have just taken the edge off, but I want them to be in a little bit of pain to remember not to move their neck. And also I'm making sure that every single person talks to that patient from the top of the stretcher and not from the side of the stretcher. So the collar's there to remind them not to turn their head.
Don't ask him yes, no questions, right? With a nodding and shaking the head.
There's even some jurisdictional services now and hospitals that are going to lanyards, essentially just a piece of string and a little label that says C-spine not cleared.
Yeah, but that's not comfortable though, Nick. Have you been on a long haul flight before?
Your head naturally wants to go forward. Just put a soft collar on.
They are the most comfortable travel pillow you'll find. You just ethically let's not use it to get prioritization from the airline staff. All right, let's just use it for travel pillow and identify. Maybe paint it like fluorescent pink or something so it doesn't look like a medical device. But they are good. Why is it then? I mean, look, these changes. You know, we're talking about soft tissue injury changes in practice taking a long, long, long time to come in, and we're talking about. I mean, the first people who were actually questioning the use of hard collars. That was 13 or 14 years ago, you know, and some services still haven't changed. Well, why is there, I guess, trepidation when we're changing practice? Why is there difficulty for people to adapt their practice?
That's a good question. I look at, and I'm going to change the topic of collars for a little bit to talk about O2 and why we've taken a lot of oxygen away from the patient. Because when I first started in the ambulance service, we'd introduce I'd walk into a job and introduce myself and put the patient on oxygen and then ask him what's going on, because that's just how we did it back in the day. But the studies proved years before we took oxygen out of, you know, giving it to everyone, stroke patients, cardiac patients, all that sort of stuff. It proved that it didn't work 30 years prior, but it's one study after another study after another study that confirms all this stuff, and it just happens ever so slowly. And Yeah, I don't know why it takes so long, but I do get the fact that if I conducted a study today, it would probably raise a question that needs another study for that question to be answered. And that's pretty much how medical research goes.
We should be encouraging these questionings.
Oh, yes, we should be.
I apologise. I just got distracted. My mother is here looking after my children, and she literally just came in with a terrified look on her face to say there's a giant worm crawling across the hallway. So I will be back in a second.
But what are your thoughts on that, Nick? Because it is, I understand how one study just opens up, talking about worms, it does open up a can of worms, and you just got to have another study to support that previous study, don't you?
Yeah. I think I wonder whether or not, you know, when we go through our education and training, we get told these, you know, you should put oxygen on this patient, you should put a Vaxplin on that patient, you should put an LMA in this patient. We get told this information almost as if they're rules per se, when realistically, in the realm of medicine, medicine is as much as of an art as it is a science. You know, just because we think we know what is right now doesn't mean we're going to still think that in 10, 20, 30 years' time when we have acquired new knowledge. So I wonder whether or not culturally when we learn things, rather than teaching people that these are hard and fast rules, we should teach them that this is what we think is the best thing to do now, and we have to be open to changing our practice and being malleable in our practice in the future as we acquire new knowledge, because it's highly likely that we are going to have to change how we do business down the track. And that's okay. That's just what medicine is all about. It's just about changing based on what we believe to be the best way to do things at that point in time. Do you think we get to like, oh, but the book says this. The book has always said this. I was like, well, the book can change and that's okay.
I think when you have guys like us, and I know Sonny's the same as well, we do question all this stuff and we don't take it for granted. And I think that's a good quality to have in a paramedic. You are allowed to question why you do things.
Question everything.
Question everything, exactly. And do the research, and if you've got if you've got 20 minutes, half an hour at station, you know, jump on and research the last job you did and you'll find out so much. And
100%. And medicine's constantly changing. Like there's this idea that surgeons, you know, if a surgeon becomes qualified per se now in 2023, all the surgeries that they're doing by the time that they retire will no longer exist. They'll be completely different surgeries, either different techniques, different technologies, because medicine will evolve in that period of time. We can almost flip it on its head and go, it's almost exciting to think that how we do paramedicine now in 2023 is going to be completely different in 10, 20, 30, 40 years' time. And just trying to consider what our world might be in 30 years is, to me, fascinating.
Yeah, very much so.
Gentlemen, I'm back. I managed to relieve my mother of the attack worm, so apologies for that.
We didn't even know you were gone. Nick and I just continued on. That was fine.
Yeah, that's right.
I just want to share a quick story. Being a fisherman and living up in the tropics, and I told you guys fishing was going to come into this podcast at some stage or another. Quite a few years back, I got stung by a box jellyfish. And it was me retrieving a lure. And when the box jellyfish are quite thick in the rivers, quite often a lure will come back with box jellyfish tentacles hanging off the lure. Because you can't touch him, I slap the lure on the surface of the water until the tentacles fly off, and eventually one day they landed on me and I got stung on my forearm. And I always carried vinegar in the boat because everyone knows you pour vinegar over a tropical jellyfish sting. So I've got this 10 out of 10 excruciating pain on my forearm because I've had a big clump of tentacles land on the inside of my forearm, and I started pouring vinegar over it, but I only had one large bottle of vinegar, so I put a bucket between my legs and poured the vinegar over my arm, caught it all in the bucket so I could reload the vinegar bottle and keep dousing the sting in vinegar. But as I started pouring the vinegar, I became diaphoretic, nauseated. I thought I was going to die. I'm about 45 minutes away from the boat ramp. I have no phone reception. I'm lying on the floor of the boat just wanting to vomit and just felt horrible. And about 10 minutes later, I started to come good, so I poured the vinegar back in the bottle, poured it over my arm again. Same thing, diaphoresis again. I did vomit the second time, and the pain was just excruciating. But I kept thinking, I've got to keep pouring vinegar over this thing, otherwise...
Because that's what everyone does.
That's what everyone does.
And we know that that neutralizes the nematocysts on the tentacles that have not triggered.
Exactly. See, that was in 2011. And in 2016, I read an article by Dr. Jamie Seymour here in Cairns, and he found out that the original research was unfired tentacles neutralized by dipping in vinegar. But when they fire, when those nematocysts are activated, vinegar makes them refire.
So up to 50% more venom.
And we're still pouring vinegar over box jellyfish things, except for me. Because I'm reading the article, I'm going, are you serious?
Now, that research by Jamie Seymour, that is nearly 10 years old, and yet everything that we still see in clinical practice still suggests vinegar. The findings of that article weren't readily accepted because it wasn't field trialed. It was an experiment done in a lab.
I field trialed it.
Sample size of one.
No, Jamie, you could be.
So this is, I mean, it's a difficult position for paramedics to find themselves in, hey, because there is obviously research that's challenging practice. Although we've moved away from protocols and more into guidelines, you know, clinicians are still expected to operate within their scope, which, you know, every organization sets. So it's a different thing. But at the same token, sometimes we have other changes in practice that do come in and paramedics are really hesitant to actually adopt. So it's a delicate seesaw of practice, isn't it?
Very much so.
Just for the listeners, I mean, the Simpsons actually, I think they were responsible for a lot of mismanagement of box jellyfish stings, because in one episode back in 1996, I think Homer peed on a jellyfish sting, and for some reason people adopted that across the planet. But let's just put the disclaimer out there too, that if you get stung by a box jellyfish and your mate pees on you to relieve your pain, you're not just going to have box jellyfish envenomation, you're also going to have your mates piss on you. It's not going to have any other benefits.
And look, some people are into that sort of thing, and we don't judge, but I do a lot of first aid courses up here on Cape York, and I just about every course I get told, oh, no, you just piss on that. And, no, you don't.
That's the Simpsons, I'm telling you. Mate, Marco, I really appreciate your time today, because being an adaptive clinician is certainly one of the skills that is less taught. We focus on so many clinical skills in paramedic care, and we don't really open the discussions or the dialogue much around, the adaptive process that paramedic care is. I mean, someone with your own experience, you said, you know, you started off with two bits of equipment and maybe one drug. And these days you're operating with hundreds of pieces of equipment and, you know, 30 or 40 drugs. So it's a big difference. You got any advice for anyone who's out there starting in paramedicine today? Or even, I mean, advice goes a long way. I think when you were mentoring me over a decade ago, you said to me that you still considered yourself a student. So just because we're experienced certainly doesn't make us immune from still learning. Any advice for any of the paramedics out there today in relation to adapting their practice?
Yeah, look, thanks, Sonny. Look, my advice to every new paramedic student is, we can teach you how to adapt your practice. We can teach you your drug therapy protocols and your guidelines. What we can't teach you is the human element of being a paramedic. And, you know, you might not think it's the greatest job in the world or the most exciting job in the world, but when people call you, you know, they're really vulnerable. You know, they want you to be professional. Yeah, that's my advice is always based around just keeping it really human, because we can lose that quite quickly after a few years running around doing this job, especially when you're in a big urban environment where you're flat out all day, every day, and that job keeps rolling on through. And, you know, and you get me on a bad day, and I'm as cranky as everybody, but, you know, just be kind to everybody, and you'll do all right in this job. I've nearly 20 years in the job, never had a complaint. And that's because I'm just nice to everybody, and you know that we went around, but I'm nice to everybody's face, you and I will probably jump in the ambulance after the job, and I'll just go, my God.
That's the human element coming out, though, hey? We've got to have our own debrief as well.
But you just got to be kind.
Yeah, yeah. Nick, we started this discussion off with adaptions to practice, and, I mean, as usual, we go down some rabbit holes, but I think it's been a lot of fun.
It's been great, mate. It's been great. Hopefully our listeners take something from it. Realistically, you just open your mind to new possibilities.
If we stay doing the same thing, nothing changes.
That's right.
I've been repeating some words that were said to me a couple of years ago to my students, and that's get curious. If there's something you're not sure about, get curious. If there's something you disagree with, get curious. If there's something you're not sure about, get curious. Stay curious and ask questions, and then things will improve.
I love it. Hey, Mark, thanks for coming on the show today.
Hey. That's awesome.
Hey, guys, it's always a pleasure. It's always good catching up with you.
Mate, always a pleasure. Thanks again, hey.
Good on you guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Sonny. Until our next episode, hopefully it won't be as much of a break this time. We'll see how we go. If you have any ideas on how we can improve the podcast, or if you have any topics you'd like us to talk about, give us an email, or you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or check out our website, www.theshiftextension.org. But until next time, see you later.